You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston tōki ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rā Mere Friday, the 4th of March. I'm Jemima, I'm your panellist for today, and I'm joined in studio by producers Casper and Liam. How are you both going?
I'm doing great, thanks, Jemima.
No problem.
I'm doing good. Nice new semester, new era of BFM.
Yes. No, so for those who don't know and have been sort of listening over the last week and heard some new voices on The Wire, we have a whole new set of Wire producers and Wire hosts on the news team at the moment. Obviously, semester one has just started this week, so we've shuffled things around and you'll be hearing from a few new voices and hearing some new people step up into hosting, which is exciting. So you'll be hearing Casper and Liam on The Friday Wire from now onwards, which is cool. Tell us what's coming up on the show.
So I talked to Auckland City Councillor Shane Henderson about the annual budget consultation and public transport costs, as well as Nick Kim, a senior lecturer at Massey University, about a recent report on hazardous chemicals in the environment.
And I have spoken to Greenpeace Plastics Coordinator Dressa Lee about the UN's work on a plastic treaty, as well as Danny Osborne about actors going into politics.
Sounds like some good stuff coming up. He aho whakaaro. If you would like to tell us what you think about these pieces, please give us a text on 5395, or you can give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Also, after the show, koua e wariwari e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga e te pai, tukutuku o Rarangi Pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. And as I say every time, the news stamp's awesome, and we have got so much work on the website. So if you have tuned in halfway through a wire and you've thought, wow, that is a really, really interesting interview and I wish that I'd heard the whole thing, you can go to the website and you can check out all our podcasts there if you just hit the wire page under our BCasts page on the website, and you can check out all the awesome stuff the news team has been doing. There's also a hell of a lot of other awesome stuff that the wider BFM family has been doing. The DJs always podcast their shows, maybe a little bit later than normal, but they will always be there, so check it out. There's some really good listening on there for you. But anyway, we've got some good stuff coming up on the show, lots of stuff, so let's crack into it now.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
This week, I spoke to Auckland Councillor for Waitakere, Shane Henderson, about the city's annual budget consultation and how and why people should get involved. We also discussed the cost of Auckland's public transport, which is becoming a topical issue with the mayoral election later this year. I started by asking him what the annual budget consultation means for Auckland residents.
Yeah, so basically every year your council consults the public on where you want us to go, what sort of things you want us to invest in, how you want to pay for it, and that's kind of the broad brush thing. But basically Auckland Council is responding to a lot of pressures, particularly climate change, which is obviously a massive issue facing the world and facing Auckland as well. The ongoing effects of COVID-19, which basically means that our public revenue has been cut by, you know, a huge amount. We're talking nearly $1 billion, I would say, over the several years so far in terms of lockdowns and things like that. So we're talking about reducing cash revenue, rising cost pressures like interest rates and inflation, growing demand for our services when we've got more and more people living in Auckland. And those are kind of the things we've got to square the circle about, is we've got less money coming in, but we've got to protect those public services that people really rely on and actually grow them in response to climate change. So just the last thing in kind of a broad brush is that you can visit akhaveyoursay.nz/budget, akhaveyoursay.nz/budget. Have a little look, and I just really encourage all of our listeners to feedback, and especially younger listeners, that we desperately need to hear your views, particularly around things like climate.
What are the particular issues on the table this year? What are the specific things that people can do to affect climate change with the budget?
Yeah, so our biggest issue obviously is climate, and we propose spending about $1 billion over the next years. Half of that will be Auckland Council money, and half of that will be matched through government and other kind of grants that we can access when we put the money in. But that's going to improve transport choice for over 1 million Aucklanders. We're looking at 10 new frequent bus routes, which is pretty fantastic. So over 1 million Aucklanders will be living within 500 metres of new or improved bus services. That's one of the things we want to do with climate, because we've got to cut those transport emissions down. Decarbonising our ferry services, increased walking and cycling, increased tree canopy cover in communities that need it the most as well. Currently, over many decades, we've assumed that the car was king in terms of getting people around and getting people through the city, and we've actually planned the city that way over the past decades. We've got to change that, and we've got 40% of our climate emissions coming from transport. That's one of the things we can really affect, and so we're going to put on a hell of a lot more bus services. But how do we pay for that? So we're paying for that through a climate action targeted rate of $57 a year on average for the median house property. And that's where we're going with it. So we're saying, look, we need to increase the services, but also that's going to cost a little bit more. So wherever you land on that, that's what we want to hear about. So that's kind of why we're consulting.
Related to the budget and climate change and all of that, the Auckland mayoral candidate, Fesso Collins, has made free public transport his major policy, and the cost of public transport has become a really topical issue. What do you believe is a fair cost of public transport, and why?
Yeah, so kind of speaking for me personally, I think there's probably two issues there. So one of them is I, the other day, heard about some intermediate school children that were kicked off buses because they didn't bring their hop cards in the middle of nowhere in the city. Now, imagine the parents and how they must have been feeling. They must have been worrying like anything. So it drives me crazy that we're still charging younger people for these kind of school bus routes and things like that through Auckland Transport. So my personal view is that I think it would be fairer to kind of shift the cost away from younger people. And you could even look at people like students as well. I was a student myself. I know we don't have a hell of a lot of money. But these are the kind of people we're desperate to, at a young age, get into the habit of public transport. So that will be my first thing and my personal kind of view on that. Secondly, the studies have shown that actually in the inner city, public transport fares are sort of in line with and maybe reasonably cheaper than a lot of the major cities in the world. But in outer suburbs, so when you look at 15 kilometres out and more, that's when it's very expensive. So I live about 15k from the city myself, and I'd be paying the fifth most expensive public transport fare in the world to get into the city. And I don't think that's what Aucklanders are expecting. I think we've got serious cost pressures on households, and we should be trying to make that fairer for people. So I'd really support calls just personally for that. So that's kind of how I feel about it. Thanks.
Do you believe a reduced cost of public transport, or even free public transport in the cities or in the suburbs or wherever, would impact the number of people using it and impact the quality of our public transport in Auckland?
Yeah, I think it absolutely would. We'd get more and more people choosing public transport when that cost barrier is removed. But I think it's really important to note we've actually got four issues, I think, that are really important. So one of them is the cost pressures of public transport. These fares are very high for a lot of people. But also we have to put in new routes where a lot of people can't access public transport in the city properly. Where there are existing routes, sometimes the buses get too full and you can be waiting on Dominion Road for three or four buses before you can actually get on one because they're so full. So we've got to address that issue. Finally, we've got to look at the driver workers' sort of welfare, looking at a living wage for drivers and good working conditions so that the bus driver is a pillar of your community again and something that's seen as a reliable and a very proud job for the city. So I think there's actually four issues, but yeah, to answer your question directly, yes, it would. I think we would get more people on public transport, especially in poorer areas like mine, that can, you know, not afford these kind of fees. They can get on the buses and, yeah, they'll feel a lot better about it.
If you would like to make a submission to the budget consultation and have your voice be heard by Auckland Council, you can visit akhaveyoursay.nz/budget.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
You're on the Friday Wire. I'm Jemima. I'm panelling the show, but really all the work is being done by Casper and Liam, who are producing Friday from now onwards. We'll be right back after a little break. If you do have any thoughts on the pieces on the show today, do send us through a text. 5395 is the number. You know that. Let us know what you think.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
No idea.
Okay, what about treasure trunks in six?
Treasure trunks? What does that even mean?
Shit, you're useless. Don't you know anything?
I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's Los Diabolos Caravan Live with support from Kilimanjaro and Soul Tree. And tomorrow, Nick Taylor Experience, followed by Manuel Bundy and TDK.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Crispness, browbone, prestidigitation. These words and more available now at UBIC, your one-stop shop for textbooks, stationery and all your general literary needs. Course-specific words like gestalt and rhizomatic, all-time classics like chess and hello. Get your semester one course books and more at UBIC. Big words, big emotions. Pop in store Monday to Friday, 8:30 to 5:30 at number 2 Alfred Street or online at ubiq.co.nz.
Wow. Music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
Our March playlist is up now and features Die Die Die, Kate Le Bon, Carl Steven, Vietnam and Local Tourist.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
You're the loser, come back. Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
This morning, the United Nations has announced the beginning of a project to see the minimization of plastic pollution throughout the planet. The next few months will see negotiations made about how we can regulate plastic pollution and what the next steps will be to combat the climate crisis. Greenpeace is campaigning for changes to be made to plastic pollution for years, and many within the organization are calling this a historic moment. I've spoken to Aotearoa Plastic spokesperson for Greenpeace, Jurissa Lee, about the treaty. Could you please go over what the recent UN treaty mandate is?
Yes, sure. So we know plastic producers are making plastic at an ever-increasing rate, and so now we're at crisis point. It's causing harm to our environment, including our human health. And we also recognise that because it's a global problem, it needs a global response that matches it in scale. So early yesterday morning at the United Nations Environment Assembly, they adopted a mandate to move forward and begin negotiations for a legally binding treaty that will address our plastic problem. So we need a strong treaty that will address and mitigate all of those harms and, you know, not just leave us with either the status quo, which is not at all addressing the plastic production and just giving us false solutions like recycling and incineration.
How could this affect the environment going forward?
Well, if we get the right kind of treaty, then that will mean it will address plastic pollution at all stages of the plastic life cycle. So we know that plastic production is polluting from the time we begin extraction of gas and oil from the ground through to manufacturing, distributing plastic products, and then its eventual waste. So a strong treaty would give us, would set a coordinated plan of actions and regulations that will work at the what we call upstream, focus on upstream, which is right at the beginning of that life cycle, where we can keep oil and plastic in the ground and essentially turn off that plastic tap.
So the recent United Nations announcement, what has that meant for the movement?
It's unprecedented, really, and it really was our one opportunity to have something that, as I said, would be a global and coordinated response that would really match the scale of the problem. You know, for example, New Zealanders, you know, have always indicated that plastic pollution, or have indicated for a long time that plastic pollution is a huge concern of theirs, and our government. They've done a bit of work in this space with some phase outs, and that's okay. We're moving in the right direction, but plastic is a global supply chain, and we have our interconnecting oceans, so it really does need to be something that we address as a planet, really. And if we didn't have it, if we don't get that, then we won't address it at all.
What is Greenpeace currently doing a campaign for this mandate to go through?
So we have, a couple of weeks ago, just leading up to this meeting, this Environment Assembly meeting, we launched a petition. We've got almost 10,000 signatures on that already. We've been campaigning our government, we've been calling on our government to make some bold moves with the plastic bottle ban and bringing in a container return scheme. On a local level, and we think that our government could do this and, you know, be world leaders in this space here. And we will just continue to keep putting the pressure on our government to make sure that they continue advocating for the strongest and most substantial treaty, because when it's not quite over yet, until it is signed, sealed and delivered, we must keep up that work.
What do you think the next steps are in curbing the plastic pollution crisis?
So in terms of the Global Plastics Treaty, now the next step will be to form an intergovernmental committee who will go away and draft what that treaty should look like. So as I said, it is still very important, and there's still many opportunities for us to keep that pressure on and ensure that that treaty does all the things that we need it to do.
Is there anything that people in Aotearoa can do right now to support Greenpeace and to support this treaty going through in a great state?
The people of Aotearoa can go onto our website and sign our petition calling on the government to continue advocating for the strongest and most substantial treaty possible, and just continue looking at the work that we're doing in that space, both domestically and in terms of this global treaty. Just keep that pressure on.
Awesome. Thank you very much for being with us. Do you have any final thoughts?
I think that's okay.
Awesome. Perfect. I will stop recording now. Sorry about that. That was Jeressa Lee from Greenpeace Aotearoa on the UN's work on a plastic pollution treaty.
Thank you so much, Liam. You're on the Friday Wire on 95BFM. Stay tuned in. We've got some more good newsy bits for you. But first, it's The Raft by Fat Freddy Strop. Stay tuned in. And my mouth is dry. Oh, this journey's told. There's a mountain high. And she burns like an ageless flame. She will give me strength so I can move again. Yeah. And though my people may not be many, we are ready for the storm to come.
Thank you. around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Yesterday, a report was released by the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, Simon Upton, which revealed startling gaps in how New Zealand monitors and records hazardous chemicals in the environment. The report found that New Zealand's regulations can often overlook environmental effects and recommends that a common framework be developed to assess and track chemicals and their environmental impacts. I spoke with Nick Kim, a senior lecturer in applied environmental chemistry at Massey University, about the significance of the findings of the report and its recommendations. I began by asking what the report is about and what its major findings are. What is this report by the Parliamentary Commissioner about, and what are its major findings?
The Parliamentary Commissioner's report is really about the gaps in our system for monitoring and managing chemicals in the environment that might affect ecosystems. So it's really focusing on the environment rather than people for a change, which is good. So the environment underpins us all. And really the gaps in the system. And in some ways I could say, well, this may be a short interview if you ask me about any particular chemical. You can pick any chemical you want. For most chemicals in the New Zealand environment that are used, we don't really know most of what's going on with them at the receiving end. So if you say, you know, someone is using a particular pesticide, is the nearby stream affected? We don't know.
So knowing that some chemicals are, or assuming that some chemicals are potentially very toxic and harmful, how have they been regulated so far? How do we not have, you know, a ton of toxic chemicals in the water if we don't have any kind of framework to deal with this?
Yeah, really good question. The toxicity is often the thing that we do focus on. We do have great systems in place for registering and quantifying toxicity and putting in rules and guidelines around how much of a toxic substance can be used. But toxicity isn't the only thing. So what we have is sort of the EPA at the national level can register a particular pesticide for use, but then they lose track of or don't know how many people are using that, where and when, and even finding data on the total use of that pesticide is really hard to do. The Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment spent 2 years on this report just trying to find adequate data on 4 different chemicals, and we're talking here about over 150,000 potential chemicals. So you can see that we don't have those systems in place even for knowing how much is being used at this stage in most cases. But down at the other end, toxicity isn't the only thing. It's some things are not particularly toxic, but if a lot of people are using them, they can accumulate in an environment and cause a lot more damage than things that are highly toxic but not used much. So give you an example. The nutrients that are going into waterways are not toxic, but they cause eutrophication of waterways. Carbon dioxide itself isn't toxic, but it's causing climate change just because of the masses being released. So that's a key thing. So what the Parliamentary Commissioner's report comes out with is we need a national framework which deals with this stuff and covers all agencies regulating chemicals, not only the EPA and MFE, but all agencies. And that needs to take into account harm, which is sort of the, you know, toxicity sort of shorthand for harm, but also it needs to take into account scale, you know, how much is being used, where, and it also needs, the third factor it needs to take into account is it actually showing up in the environment? Because there are some things we worry about a lot that we go and do measurements in the environment, so say, well, it's not actually there, so, you know, why would we prioritise that thing? Actually, if anyone's interested in this, you know, the report really says it all, but it is a long report. It does have summary pages, summary parts to it, though, so I'd suggest seeking that out.
So despite New Zealand's green image, how is it that the country got so far behind in not having this common framework to deal with these different chemicals and not even knowing how much is being used where?
Yeah, well, I'm a sort of technical specialist, and the only thing I can say is it's probably politics. I can point out that the Parliamentary Commissioner sent a letter to all the ministers back in 2019 to say that we are the only country in the OECD, New Zealand's the only country that doesn't have a pollutant release and transfer registry, And that's a requirement in all other OECD countries that industries using and discharging chemicals have to report back to a national agency annually on their use and release of chemicals. So in other countries, even Australia, you can look up what's being released in a local factory. Here you can't. Now, as far as we know, the government's response to that 2019 letter to ministers, which you can find online, was nothing. They did nothing. And subsequent to that, there was a second report that Phil Pennington, RNZ, has pointed out was about the compliance. Again, very little done. And this report has all the hallmarks, I'm afraid, of being another one that the government will probably just hope has a quick burial, because it's already had some comments back from EPA about a few things they're doing. But just looking at their own comments, they are woefully inadequate relative to the issues that are identified in the report.
That was Nick Kim speaking about a recent report by the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment on tracking hazardous chemicals in the environment. If you are interested in finding out more and would like to read the report, it can be found at pce.parliament.nz/publications.
Thank you, Casper. You're on the Friday Wire. We've got one more piece for you, a very interesting piece produced by Liam about why are actors going into politics? So do stay tuned in. Send us through a text, 5395. We'll be right back after this.
We're looking to hire a news and editorial director. In this role, you'll set the news and editorial agenda for 95BFM, maintaining the style and content of our coverage regardless of what's happening in mainstream news. You'll source, train and mentor the volunteers that make up our news team. And, of course, you'll be someone who understands 95BFM's perspective and values. So if you've got a passion for journalism and fostering new broadcasting talent, apply now. Go to 95BFM.com. Applications close Sunday.
You've heard the Dunedin sound. Now taste the Dunedin taste. Iconic Scarfy Burger joint Reburger has arrived in Auckland, and we're celebrating by giving away a gourmet burger combo every weekday on 95BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Just listen in every weekday evening from 4 till 7, and when you hear the dinner gong, text in for your chance to win the dinner gong. Thanks to Reburger, only on 95BFM.
We'll be right back. old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
Almost as long as the entertainment industry has existed, actors and public entertainers have been transitioning from the screen to politics. Several examples from tens of countries around the world has seen actors fail and succeed, with their success as a politician varying widely from Donald Trump to Vladimir Zelensky. I spoke to University of Auckland political psychology professor Danny Osborne to learn more about whether or not entertainers becoming politicians is normal or a phenomenon. Why do you think that people working in the entertainment industry might believe that they should join politics?
Well, having been in the entertainment industry really gives potential politicians a leg up on the competition because of the name recognition that goes along.
Do you believe that this is a new phenomenon, or is it something that we've seen throughout history across nations?
No, we've definitely seen it repeated throughout history. So, for example, maybe one of the more well-known examples of this might be Ronald Reagan. So people often forget that Reagan, before he entered politics, was an actor and quite a well-known one. Another example would be Arnold Schwarzenegger, who after a very successful movie career, wound up becoming the governor of California. Manny Pacquiao, who was a boxer, is now a senator in the Philippines. So you see it in country after country, decade after decade, that people in the entertainment industry using their name recognition to then make a difference in politics.
Many of these entertainers' runs do tend to be unsuccessful, but many do. Why do you think that people vote for them over someone with a political background?
The thing is, as much as we'd like to believe that voters are perfectly informed and make rational decisions, oftentimes it's a matter of name recognition. So if you're running a campaign against somebody like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who 99.9% of the population has heard of, versus Joe Smith, you know, a large proportion of voters are going to go for Schwarzenegger based on name recognition.
Do you think that this is an issue, or do you think that this is a good thing going forward?
It's a great question, and I think it depends on your view of politics, really. So if you think that, you know, you need to go in and drain the swamp and get rid of kind of the corruption that exists within politics and elect a person, a representative of the people, then maybe having somebody who hasn't had a history in politics is a good thing. Conversely, it could also signify like it could be a negative indicator of the competence of the electorate. Because if you're just voting for people if you're just voting for people because they're famous, then you're not necessarily getting your policies represented in Parliament.
Currently, the most prevalent example that's in the media right now is Vladimir Zelensky, who is the current president of Ukraine, who previously worked as an actor and a comedian, including playing a satirical version of the Ukrainian president in a sitcom that then the television production company ended up setting up a political party and they won. In that kind of insane circumstance, do you think that the television studio itself could play a role, or do you think that it's still based on the name recognition?
I think it goes back to the name recognition again. So Zelensky, having been a successful actor in the Ukraine, or a comedic actor in the Ukraine, there's a pretty well-known incumbency effect in political science, whereby if you're running for a position that you've previously held, you're more likely to get elected. And the main reason behind that is, again, because of this name recognition. Now, obviously, a comedic actor doesn't have that incumbency effect, but they definitely have that name recognition and the ability to be known by voters. And so I think Zelensky, when he initially ascended to the office, had that advantage over the incumbent.
Obviously, Ukraine is now unfortunately in the midst of war. However, the general public's response on him from being in Ukraine specifically, what I've seen is that it was generally positive with some criticism. But at the moment, not just within the country, but within the entire world, Zelensky has been getting praise for his work, not just because of his background, but because of him staying in Kyiv, because of him working with the country, trying to be as diplomatic as possible. Do you think that because of this, we could see voters turn more towards people who have more regular backgrounds in their lives rather than people who have a political background or even people who don't have an entertainment background? People may become more attracted to those who have similar careers to themselves.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Zelensky is doing a phenomenal job, and, you know, seeing how Zelensky has handled the crisis unfolding in Ukraine has been, like, truly inspiring. You know, a couple of days ago, he came out and said, "I'm not iconic. Ukraine is iconic." And, you know, those types of soundbite messages that the whole world can identify with and brings attention to the horrible scenario that's unfolding in Ukraine at the moment. They're really highly salient examples of a person with an entertainment background successfully transitioning into politics. And I think it is something that could potentially influence voters down the line, because oftentimes the critique of these former entertainers is, you have no history in politics. How do you expect to change the system? Well, Zelensky is a very salient example of someone who didn't have a history in the politics per se, but who is having an influence around the globe.
Yeah, I mean, you mention how he has those sound bites going on that are possibly quite unique to those in politics who can have those quotes because they've been working with people who write this stuff for a living as a form of entertainment. So they're trying to get it into their heads. They're trying to make it as memorable as possible. And do you think that that plays a role?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, an entertainer is the ideal political candidate. You know, their job up to that point has been connecting with people and being effective public speakers. And Zelensky is certainly demonstrating those skills at the moment. I mean, there's certainly much, much more to politics in terms of deal making and making sure that your policies go through and the kind of difficulties around that. But the public speaking component of having been an entertainer is certainly playing towards these successful examples that we've seen throughout history.
That was political psychology professor Danny Osborne on entertainers entering politics.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the show for another week. Massive thank you to you for tuning in and listening to the show today and sending us through your texts. We really appreciate it. Always keep those coming on The Wire. Big thank you, of course, has to go to Casper and Liam for producing the show. How do you feel it went?
I think quite well, yeah.
Very happy. I'm very excited for the rest of the semester. I think that we're going to have some good stuff going on.
I definitely think so too. I'm very much looking forward to listening and seeing the sort of pieces you produce.
Thank you. So,
yes, it'll be exciting. Right, and a big thank you as well to the people who spoke with us for the show today. Always awesome how much time people give the 95BFM newsroom to produce the stories that we do. So massive thank you to them as well. I hope you have a lovely afternoon out there and that you're taking care of yourself. And if you're in isolation, that you're enjoying BFM and you're staying tuned in as much as possible, because there's some good stuff on. But yes, stay tuned in. Up next is Land of the Good. My goodness, it's Friday! Land of the Good Groove is up next. Stay tuned in. Listen to BFM. It's the best place to be. Matua.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.